I'm so grateful that I get to be here with you because I majorly screwed up in September and you had me back. So if you weren't here, what happened was that I I love details and I have spreadsheets. I could show you it all on my computer. Somehow this group didn't land on my calendar. So when I looked at the week, I had nothing to do. And I live up in Calabasas. So at like 9 o'clock, sweet Jill's like, "Are you coming?" And I'm like, "Where?" And so, as you can imagine, it was about 3 days of just like feeling horrible for missing out your opening mops. So the funny part is, have you ever been to a party where they ask you to do two truths and a lie? Or worse, they say in front of a bunch of strangers, tell your most embarrassing moment, you know? Well, you guys, September is on that list now for me. So I have an easy grab story. And so what do you do when you want to make sure you get somewhere on time? I mean, my mom drive me. So my mom's here. Truth. Oh, man. So anyways, I'm really excited to talk to you about this topic because it is my heartbeat. Like, I've been working with kids for years and years. I was a children's pastor for 15 years and most recently spent 7 years at Malibu Presbyterian Church. So a similar demographic maybe to where we are right now. And just really walking with my friends there to say, I hadn't met a single family yet that has said, "Hey, Christy, we're bringing our kids to church because we're hoping to raise a spoiled brat." I haven't met them, you know? Most people really want to raise kids that are grounded, confident, and have every opportunity they need. But often I've seen people take a turn towards allowing their kids to have everything and think everything is sort of a given in a way that really hampers their development. So we're going to talk about a lot of things, but what this all started out with was I was on a date with David, and we were at one of those places, you know, the big multiplex place where you have Yogurtland and Barnes & Noble and the movie theater and a restaurant or two or five, you know. And a group of kids came running by us so fast that they barely noticed that we were standing there, almost knocked David over. And because I've been a children's pastor for all these years, everything in me has to be reminded that I'm not in charge when I'm in public and there are children running around. Because I just naturally want to be like, "Hey guys, slow down over here, over there. Okay, I'm directing traffic." But David turned to me, he's like, "Just let it go." I'm like, I know. And 2 weeks later, I found myself on this road, the dirt streets of the Dominican Republic, standing amongst the poorest of the poor, people who live on less than 50 cents a day. Now, the international poverty line, extreme poverty line, according to the World Bank, sits at $1.90 a day. So you have to understand, these people who are on the border of Haiti and the Dominican Republic are very, very poor. They grow coffee plants that are sold to American coffee roasters, which I thought was interesting. And they brought us there really because they wanted us to really see how very connected we are to the poor, how personal poverty is. Because it's easy to get removed, isn't it? It's easy for life to go by. Man, it's easy. The other day, we just came back from India in January. I'll tell you more about that later. But even that experience with poverty, that's very personal to us. David turns to me and I said, "You know what I would do? I would just get rid of all this furniture in this room. I would just get rid of all of it and start over." And he said, "Wow." He's like, "I bet that's what Rohit, our sponsored child, says." And I'm like, "Okay, all right. You're right. I'm fine." But it's true that this entitlement lives in me. It's loud and clear. Well, as these kids, you see, are up living in the hills of the Dominican Republic, a friend of mine starts to do this trick with, he does magic tricks. So he was totally cool with these kids. And he's doing magic tricks with Oreos. And I'm thinking with my children's pastor brain, don't hand one Oreo to one kid. We've got a lot of kids. We don't have a lot of Oreos. Your moms, you'd be with me on this, right? It's like, you're going to have a total, like, riot on your hands, you know? So sure enough, he gets down to his last Oreo, and little Victor, who's standing right in front of him, says in Spanish, "May I have an Oreo?" And I learned right then that there's no language barrier when it comes to double-stuffed Oreos. And he takes the Oreo, and I brace for the worst. And just then, Victor taught me something as he takes a bite, passes it to his friend, who takes his bite and passes it to his friend. And I stood there, friends, with tears in my eyes as I watched five children eat one Oreo. And I thought, God, what are you showing me? Why is it that kids that have more than enough know how to share and live in community? And yet kids like myself and like kids that I've known run and grab for more, thinking it'll make them happy. And I thought, we've got a problem. So I did what you do when you're curious about something. I Googled it. And what I found was that there's all these studies right now coming out of our most prestigious universities that show that empathy is on the decline by close to 40 to 50%. Let me show you. So college students today are about 40% less empathetic than they were just 20 or 30 years ago. Now, the steepest decline, which is coming out of the studies out of Harvard, Stanford, Berkeley, all show that the steepest decline has happened in the last 10 years. Now, you guys are smart. What do you think happened in the last 10 years that might have caused this issue to happen? Smartphones, yeah. So there is a direct correlation. It's not the only correlation, but there's a direct correlation between the amount of screen time a person has had and their level of empathy. Isn't that interesting? It's good to know, right? Because it's easy to go to the screens. I'm telling you, this is my own struggle, too. That I'm constantly having to set boundaries for myself on how much time I have behind a screen because our work is there, our social life is there, everything happens behind a screen. So Apple came out with the first iPhone, can you believe it, only in 2007, that's it. Remember, it was about half this size, right? This is a 6 Plus, so it is the giant, almost iPad one, but things have changed. When I was growing up, our family would gather around in the living room on Monday nights and watch Seventh Heaven. Woo! Anybody a Seventh Heaven fan? Okay. And we'd watch it together and we'd have a shared experience with our screen, our one Zenith 1985 TV in the house, right? We told Dad, there's new TVs out. Best Buy has them for you, but he didn't get a flat screen until about 2005 or 2006, you know, kept going with the Zenith, you know. But our relationship to screens have changed so much, but so does our behavior towards them need to change. And that's what I want to talk about, not just screen time, but how entitlement is linked to empathy. That actually, if you have more empathy, you're more connected to the needs and feelings of others. But if you have less empathy, there's a greater chance that you're in a survival mode. Because with less empathy comes more anxiety and depression. Suicide rates are through the roof right now, guys. Our mental health as a culture is really not very healthy. And so we have all these solutions, but yet I really want to look at what is at the root of that tree. What's growing things in kids where they don't know how to make eye contact, connect, and have friendships that are deep and lasting and sustaining. And that's what empathy, how we measure empathy, right? It's how can you sustain eye contact? Can you form an interpersonal relationship with someone and imagine what it's like to be in their shoes? Stepping into the shoes of someone else. But before we go on, let's define empathy the real way. Okay, so here you go. This is just for fun.
Hello, I'm Mark.
And I'm Murray.
And we're here to tell you about the word empathy.
Empathy, yes, empathy.
Tell them about the word empathy. What's wrong?
You're not going to believe this, Mark.
What?
But I can't remember what empathy means.
No, that's okay, that's okay. I'll tell them what empathy means.
Oh, boy, this is so exciting. Mark Ruffalo is going to tell us about empathy. Oh, boy, oh, boy, oh, boy, oh, boy.
Can I do it?
Go, please, go for it, Mark.
All right, Empathy is when you're able to understand and care about how someone else is feeling.
Oh, right. That's what empathy is.
Yes, yes.
I don't get it.
What?
Sorry.
Okay, okay. Let me see if I can explain it to you in some way.
Okay, I'm going to listen.
Let's say I'm walking along and... Oh!
What?
I stubbed my toe. Oh, that hurts.
Oh, you poor thing.
Murray.
Oh,
Murray.
That hurts. I can imagine exactly how you feel.
That's it.
Why? What's it?
That's it. That's empathy.
What's empathy?
You could imagine exactly how I feel. You could understand just how it felt. That's empathy.
I still don't get it.
What?
I still don't get it.
Okay. Okay. Let's think of another way.
Okay, let's think of another way. Thinking.
Oh, Murray.
What?
Did I tell you about that time when I lost my favorite teddy bear?
Oh, no.
It was...
Oh, this is very sad. Did you love that teddy bear?
I loved that teddy bear.
Oh, I can imagine exactly how you feel. It's really sad feeling. It makes me want to cry like this.
It was sad. It was so sad. But you know what? You know what empathy is.
I do?
That was empathy.
What?
You could understand how I was feeling, exactly how I was feeling, and understood it. That's empathy.
I get it now. Yes! Yes, I get it!
Yes!
I understand
yes.
empathy!
You understand empathy,
I'm
Murray.
I'm so happy right now.
I'm happy too.
It makes me want to dance the dance of happiness.
I can imagine exactly how you feel. What? I want to dance the dance of happiness too.
Then what are we waiting for?
Let's do it!
Anybody want Mark to explain a few more words while we're at it? What I love about this is it's fun, but also it shows us that modeling empathy is the only way we're going to get it through their heads. That it's not through telling them over and over again to care about other people. While that's good, transformation happens from the inside out, doesn't it? It's when we experience and feel something on our own that we're prompted to change. And that's why for all the work we've done with anti-bullying and character counts and trying to spur and grow kind kids, why is it that the last 20 years have been focused on that and yet we have this steep decline? I think it's similar to what Jesus spoke about with the Pharisees where he said, you know, your rules are external. I'm interested in your heart. And so it's really in how do we cultivate experiences and relationships that will help transform the lives and hearts of our kids. That is, we're leading them into their generation, because they're going to be leading, right? So right now, when they're little, we have an incredible opportunity to pour deep truth into their soul so that as they grow, they'll be rooted and grounded in friendships that they can count on for empathy. Can you imagine going to coffee with someone and them having no empathy? You might know somebody like this, who you sit across from you and share something from your heart, and they're like, I don't know what that would feel like. You know? It's like, I'm not going to share with my unempathetic friends. I'm going to share with people who can connect to my feelings. So empathy is powerful and important in a thousand ways. And I believe it's the antidote to entitlement. That the more we understand our place in the global world, to see our place in the haves and the have-nots even, to understand that when you continue to compare up and say, man, my car isn't as sexy as her car, and my car, you'll always lose at that game. It's always in looking at what we have and being incredibly grateful for every moment, everything we have. And so I've put together 5 different messages that I believe if we plant at the soul of our kids as they grow, that they will thrive in a way that my hope is the researchers will soon say, oops, I'm giving my secrets away, is that the researchers will say, not again, we like you, Mark, but not again. The researchers will say, these kids turned the corner. They knew how to use technology, not let it use them. They knew how to connect with others, and they were taught and raised to believe that they're good enough just as they are, and that they are a vessel of love and light to pour that into others and into the world. Sound good? So, okay, the first one, life is hard, which just sounds so harsh, right, when we're thinking of little cute little toddlers or preschoolers. But the truth is, if we don't expose kids to the hard things in life early, they don't develop the emotional muscles it requires to thrive when they enter and emerge into adulthood. I love reading more and more on this because it just, it's so important. For example, friends of mine just had a baby girl, and we were at the hospital, and her dad was the anti-back police, okay? Anybody have a husband like that? Yeah, it's like everybody must be lathered in anti-back before you can get near, not touch, near our child. And so we totally respected all the hand-washing rituals, all of it. We're like, we are for you, we are for your baby, and we don't want them to be germed up at all. But what we were talking about was that, you know, down the road, as that baby's gotten older, you have to expose your children to germs, right? Or else they don't develop the immunities they need to fight off the hard things that come their way. Well, similarly, when we allow kids to experience the hard things that do come their way, then life will be hard, right? There's no way to insulate them from that. They then have what they need to move forward. My friend Michelle told me I could tell this story about her two daughters. She's now parenting a college student and a high schooler, and she parented them mostly as a single parent. Her husband was always on the road as a musician, and so she said, "Chrissy, what I learned is just because we have doesn't mean we should. Just because we can doesn't mean we should." And so for their oldest, they gave her everything. I mean, 5-star resorts, the whole deal, just everything. Oh, you have everything you need. And what ended up happening was the minute they dropped her off at NYU at age 18, she couldn't. Like, she didn't have it in her. It was the big, bad streets of New York. Now, I don't know if I could have handled it either, you know. But she called up and said, "Hey, Mom, I'm out of money." 2 weeks in. She's like, "That money was supposed to last you a semester." She said, "Yeah, but Mom, the Uber rides and the restaurants, they're so expensive here." Can you imagine your child calling up and being like, "All the food in the Village, on the east side of the Village, is just expensive, you know? Like, what about the college cafeteria? Oh, I'm not going to eat there." And that's the reality. She hadn't had this, like, need to learn how to eat at the college cafeteria. And I believe there's a developmental step there that's necessary. I mean, I held 75 cents in my hands and went, "Laundry or Taco Bell? What am I going to do, right? Sniff, sniff, Taco Bell. We can do this." The point is, all along the way, we have to allow our kids to experience the world around them. Now, that sounds scary, right? Because we have the world around us coming at us at HD. We can see war. We can see mass shootings unfold on Facebook Live. That happened just the other couple months ago. I was watching, getting ready to come speak somewhere, and something was unfolding in Ohio, and I was literally, it came up on my Facebook feed in live. Like, I could see it happening. I thought, the world has changed, hasn't it? And the world has changed, and it will change more and more and more. And so it's in being watchful, not fearful, connected to what's happening so that we can be a resource for our kids, so that when they are emerging into each new season, we're saying, "Hey, let's figure out Instagram." I have a friend who was saying, "My son wants Instagram." I said, "Are you on Instagram?" He said, "No." I said, "Get on Instagram." He said, "I don't want to do all that stuff." And I'm like, "Fine, then you won't have a lot of say." So he got on Instagram. He figured it out, even though it was counter to what he didn't want to do all that junk, you know. I said, don't just shut it out. Learn it. Understand its value. Understand why your son wants that so bad, so that you can have conversations that are real with him. You see, some of the research also shows that empathy goes down because we have too much information coming towards us. Do you ever feel that way? When Columbine happened, I remember weeping in front of the TV. When Katrina happened, I was weeping in front of the Today Show thinking, how can I help? But as more of it builds up, there is a reality to the way we're built and formed that we sometimes say, I can't feel all this sadness. It's too much. And so it's important also to filter the amount of content coming on in your home, infiltrating our lives. I want to be aware, I want to be informed, but I don't want to be consumed. I don't want to be obsessed. I don't want to be afraid all the time. And in fact, that is how the media makes money, keeping me glued right there, right? I was in second grade when one of the earthquakes in LA happened, and I remember my dad showing me the news, the local news, and how they had shown, it looked like devastation everywhere. He said, "Christy, only one building fell down. And it was an old building, and it's okay." I'm like, "I don't want to sleep in my room by myself. I'm so scared. I don't want to." I said, "Christy, let me show you. They're showing four sides of the same building." And I'm like, "Oh." So it's understanding how the content that comes our way is formed so that we then can deal with it as well, and helping our kids have a healthy relationship with that rather than an obsessed, constant need to know so that they can avoid catastrophe. Does that make sense? So what's connected to this point is you will come through this. You can't say life is hard without teaching kids how to come through the hard things. And this will be one of the most important and pivotal things we ever do as we lead children. Emotion coaching, emotion regulation, there's many names for this, but some of the work emerging from just up the street at UCLA is just incredible in really understanding. We have so much knowledge now about how the brain functions that we also need to be aware of how we move through just the uncomfortable moments in life. And there's a reality that when something uncomfortable happens to us, we feel it in our body, don't we? Do you ever have that feeling where we say, "Man, I feel it in my gut," or you can feel it rising up in your chest? And often we try and avoid those feelings because we don't like the feeling, right? It's uncomfortable. But I learned from a psychologist at Pepperdine. She told me it only lasts 90 seconds. Can you believe that? Most of the uncomfortable feelings we avoid usually only last 90 seconds in our body. They might return. But what she uses with kids is to say, ride the wave. Sit with it. What are you feeling? What hurts? What's hard? Ride the wave. Because if you run from it in every direction, we see that so much in our lives, don't we? With loved ones and friends who struggle with addiction, with my own sometimes need for carbohydrates when I'm feeling a little low, you know? Anybody else? Carbs? Okay, I'm the only one. Cool, you guys are all vigilant paleo. Good for you. Just kidding. The reality is I was sitting with a woman after I spoke, and she said, "I need to talk to you after." And I said, "Okay." And so we talked, and she said, "You know, Christy, I work in a drug and rehab facility, and this is what we're teaching our adults, is how to move through uncomfortable feelings." She said, "Tell parents, if they can teach this early, if you can allow your kids to interact with their bully and have conversations that say, 'You hurt my feelings and I don't like it,' or when that moves to a point where you have to step in," obviously there are moments where we have to step in, "we allow our kids to see that there are certain behaviors that aren't allowed, there are certain that are, but really a lot of the things they face, they can deal with on their own." I've heard it said that every story has a hero. Have you heard that before? Every story has a hero. It's basic English 101, right? But every story has a trusted guide and companion. And often, in the last generation, parents stepped in too quick into that hero role, took over, and stepped in and say, "I got this." And that's where we have a whole generation of kids that have a failure to thrive once they get to college. And so it's really in giving them those emotional muscles that will help them really get strong. I helped lead a MOPS group in Malibu for 7 years. And 8 months after I got to that church, the church burned to the ground on a Sunday morning. Not the plan, not the way I expected life to go, but an adventure that I wouldn't take back for $1 million. And so our first MOPS meeting that we had without our building we found a Salvation Army camp that opened their doors to us in Malibu Canyon. Well, as you can imagine, how many of you are on MOPS steering? Anybody? Yeah, okay, bodies of water everywhere with no fences. Like, just think, dropping your kids off there, and I'm thinking in leadership, oh boy, this is not gonna go well. Well, sure enough, separation anxiety was at its all-time high. And my friend Kate's son is very sensitive, could pick up on all of it, and he was melting down. But I knew Kate needed some time, right? I knew she needed to be at her table. So I'm holding Isaiah, and I'm trying to get him to be quiet. And I'm like, hey, Isaiah, stop. Hey, buddy, stop crying. Isaiah, I need you to stop crying. I'm trying every way, every tone of voice. And he's still wailing. And finally, Isaiah takes his two little hands and his towhead blonde hair and his big blue eyes. He pushes his hands on my shoulders. He looks me in the eyes, and he says, Miss Christie, is it okay with you for me to be sad? Yes, it is. Whoa, right? First of all, the emotional intelligence of this three-year-old, woo, you know? But just his away, is it okay for me to be sad with you? That's the exact words. Is it okay for me to be sad with you? I thought, yeah, it is. And I figured this is probably what his parents are teaching him. So I said, okay, Isaiah, let it out. I'm here for you. I've got you. Let it out, buddy. I know it can feel sad to have mom go away. And do you know he calmed down so quickly after that? Now, this isn't a magic trick, okay? I hate to break it to you, but not a magic trick, but definitely a tool. When we're interacting with even our spouses, even our friends, and especially our kids, to say, let it out. I'm creating space for you. You can feel your feelings. And when we give people permission to feel their feelings, often it doesn't last as long as it does when we say, stop, halt, don't do this. I don't want to, this is inconvenient, uncomfortable for me. I have to feel my feelings. If you feel your feelings, all of that, just create space. Take deep breaths. And then help kids move through it. And so often one way we've talked about is that you say, let it out, and then when you kind of feel like, hey, now we're kind of milking it, you know? You ever have a kid that just milks it, like, oh, I'm still hurting because I love your hug. Say, all right, what are we going to do now? Let's move on and distract them. And that process can be really healthy, not to distract, but to say, let me help you move through this. And if you need to cry again, we can do that again. But let's go find something to do. Let's color. Let's go play a game. Let's do something else. And so all of these notes, these little things I'm mentioning, I've put together in a little PDF for you so that you don't have to worry about all the names. I'm going to give you a few more quotes and studies and things like that. So if you would like to grab your phone real quick, I've put them on this. They'll just literally text right to your email inbox. This doesn't go anywhere else. It's just literally me sending you something. That's it. And so if you want to text the number 44222, the word all together, not case sensitive, you can do lower or upper, grow empathy. I'll give you 15 seconds to do that, and we'll move on to our next point. Okay, I'm going to go on and read a quote for you real quick. This is comes from one of our mentors. His name is Dr. Tim Elmore. If you're familiar with his work, his organization is called Growing Leaders. And in that PDF, I have a link to his books and things like that. He is so good. His his book, Generation IY, is just a wealth of resources for how to parent well and how to lead kids well, whether you're parenting or not. We are all leading the next generation just by living our lives around them. They're watching us, so it's pretty cool. But this says, oh wait, this isn't Tim's. So sorry. I'm going to read you one of Tim's later, so now you know who he is. This is a quote by Kenneth Bardish. He says, emotion regulation means being able to think constructively about how to cope with feelings. We want children to have their feelings but not be overwhelmed by them, to feel discouraged but not give up, to feel anxious but not stay home, to be excited but not get so carried away in their enthusiasm that they use poor judgment in making decisions. So that's a good summary of what emotion coaching and emotion regulation can do for kids and what it looks like. The next is people matter most. I was working at a church in Newhall, California for about 3 years when I got a phone call about December 20th from a man, and he said, I've got a problem. And I said, okay, hopefully not with me, I thought inwardly. But he said, no, I'm a friend of your friend Mike's. Well, my friend Mike owns a car shop, so he knows all these guys that are car guys. And if you know car guys, they want to fix everything, right? So he said, I need you to fix my daughter. And I said, oh, I don't know how much I can do about that. But he said, well, let's just say I got my Christmas list from her, and it's a very designer and very expensive Christmas list, and I'm just a little grossed out. And I said, okay. He said, what I need you to do is I need you to find me a family that she can go and buy presents for. I said, oh gosh, I'm really sorry, but we've actually already done all of that. It's the end of Christmas season. We're getting ready for Jesus' celebration at church, you know? But let me take your number. If anything comes up, I'll definitely call you. And so we talked a little bit longer. I wrote his number down. 2 hours later, my phone rings again. It's this woman, Mary, that I know that runs the single mother's outreach in that area. And she says, Christy, I know it's such short notice, but I had a family come in, long story, but one of those stories, friends, that you'll never forget, you know? Dad's gone to jail and he'll never see his kids again, and that's a good thing. The horrible story that leads up to that is pretty awful. But we got her an apartment. We got her a car. The kids are in school. Do you know anybody that would be willing to go shopping for them and get them a few Christmas presents? And I said, Mary, you're not going to believe this, but 2 hours ago, this guy called me, and let me call him back. So I said, do you have their list? She said she had their list. Called him back. He said, great, we're on it. So 3 days later, I meet him at their apartment, which is government-assisted housing, and we're going through the alleys, and his daughter is juicy coutured up with the little dog. It was the Paris Hilton days, guys, so this was like totally the look, right? And she is like, and I'm thinking, wow, this is going to be interesting. I went because I was afraid of two worlds colliding in a way that wouldn't be lovely. As we're walking in, I said, hey, guys, like, we're not going to necessarily open all these presents. We're going to leave them for them so they can have their Christmas. But we don't normally even bring you with us to give these, but here we are, you know? So we go in, and the mom is so sweet and just crying, thank you so much. And these people had gone to every length, this man and his daughter, 5 gifts per kid, wrapped with bows, with names, $200 for mom to go to Ralph's and buy groceries so they could have Christmas dinner. Just generous. And I saw a crack in the little girl's face where she looked around, and I realized she was very much connecting to this moment. So we put the tree, there's a little tiny tree, and we put all the presents around it. And she said, you know what, can we open one present in front of you just so that we can enjoy this together? And it's up to you. So kids open a present, and the littlest boy, 5 years old, who had gone through the most horrific abuse, okay, who just had to say goodbye to his dad, as complicated as that relationship is, he's on the floor, and he's unwrapping a remote control car. not on his Christmas list, out of his wildest dreams, kids out of his mind, a remote control car, you know? And then he totally breaks and loses it. And he goes, "We don't have batteries." And I just thought, man, buddy, I know it's not about the batteries. This is about so much more. But man, those batteries are sure the focus. And I get it. When things just don't work, you know? And this man comes over. He goes, "Buddy, buddy, buddy, I brought batteries." And he sat there and goes, "Come here, honey." Gives it to him. And I see a father and a son. They're not by blood related, but there they are connecting. And he puts the batteries in his room. "Let's see it go." And they're, his tears are wiping out of his face and everything's better, you know, for a minute. And I just thought, there, that's it. People matter most. And this man wanted to teach his daughter that, to show her all you have doesn't matter if you don't get that people are more important than things. You can give them everything you want, all the princess birthday parties they could ever dream of. It's all fun. But if kids don't get the true value order of this world, it's just a gross emptiness for life. I met a woman who shared her story with me, a very personal story. She said I could share it with you. She came to the United States pregnant, not realizing it. She went to the, well, let me back up. She got here and she decided she was going to try her first American food. I think this is hilarious, at JFK. And she ate her first bite of hot dog, okay? I'm like, a hot dog at the airport. We can do better for you in America. Like, we've got your back, you know? She got sick when she ate that hot dog, went to the restroom, got sick. And said, "I swear I will never eat that nasty American food again." She got to the apartment in Minneapolis, Minnesota, 2-bedroom, 2-bath, 5 brothers, 2 parents, and herself. That is a total of 8 people, okay? It's a true immigrant story, right? And finally, after a few weeks of getting sick in the morning, she turned to her brother and she said, "John, I'm pregnant. I don't know what to do." He said, "How did this happen?" She said, "Really? Do we have to have this conversation, you know?" And she goes, no, listen. He said, "Well, you're not married." She said, "Well, I have this boyfriend." And so she had this secret boyfriend in India that no one knew about. No one knew his name. No one knew who he was. She would sneak off. She had stories she'd tell. She'd sneak off and connect with him. Turns out he was her mother's rickshaw driver, okay? So we're talking different classes, different ages, all of it, and definitely different religions. So not the arranged marriage that everyone would have dreamed for her. So finally it goes along, and she has this baby. 2 pounds, 4 ounces, this little baby boy, born in Minneapolis, Minnesota, by God's grace. Because had he been born in India, the story would have gone really differently. Probably wouldn't have come home from the hospital. But eventually, he came home into this house full of people who really weren't planning on having a baby anytime soon. None of them. They were thinking, what is going on? What are we going to do with this baby? There was no crib. There was no baby shower. None of that. No room for him. But they tried to figure it out. Finally, mom... The uncles were so ashamed of this baby, they said, "You will be the shame of our family," to their sister. "How dare you do this when we first come to America?" Fast forward a few months, and grandma and grandpa said, "We will love this child, and so will you, and knock it off." I like grandma and grandpa, you know. And they stepped into that parent role. They stepped into it and said, "This child matters more than our rules. This child matters more than all of our beliefs about how things are supposed to be. This child is precious." And grandpa found a church just down the road that he could walk to. He didn't have a car, didn't have a driver's license. So he walked this little boy to Sunday school. I'll show you a picture of him. Come on, right? And these white Minnesota ladies, don't you know, at this Wesleyan church, welcomed him in. And they didn't just welcome him in sort of as like a charity case, but as one of their own. And they said, you want to come over for a play date? Hey, you guys want to come over for hot dish? They loved him, and they made room for him at their tables in their homes for sleepovers so he could see what a thriving family looked like. And it turns out he ended up, they invited him to be in their Cub Scout troop. And he went to summer camp and had a camp girlfriend. Come on, is that like an 80s or 90s like summer camp picture if I ever saw one? I love the back-to-back girls. They like totally did that for cheer pictures probably. Is there some good bangage going on? Yeah, it's a little late for the bangs, I feel like, but hey, it's the Midwest, right? And 3 years ago, I got to stand at the back as I watched this man get married, this little boy, now a man. And I thought about his whole story, and I had tears in my eyes. And then I walked down the aisle, and I married him. Aww. Yeah, so this is our story. This is the story we're living. Is how you take the pieces of your life and you make something that was hard, something that's painful, something that where you feel like, was I even meant to be? Those are some of the words David has uttered. I don't know. No one really wanted me, and I kind of knew that when I was a little kid, he said. And we have made our life work about protecting children from that kind of story. From a story that says, was I meant to be? There doesn't seem to be enough for me here. To a story that says, there's enough for you, there's a plan for you, and even if the humans didn't have a plan, God does. And so poverty got really personal for me when I heard the first story about his father. His father lives in India. David's only met him 3 times. He lives on less than about $2 a day. We don't know exactly. But he works 12 hours a day in a really bad part of town, selling magazines, working 6 days a week. And as I walked down the streets with him this January, poverty got really, really personal for me. As I stood there and I imagined, this is where David could have grown up. Or had David been born here, he wouldn't have survived these streets. What would this have done to his personality? How would this have shaped him? How does poverty's story shape the human soul? And so it was actually as we were engaged and we were sitting in front of a pile of beautiful presents from Pottery Barn and Crate and Barrel and all of that, that David said to me, honey, do we need all of this? Now, I got married when I was 33, so friends, I had waited a long time for these showers to happen. And I was ready when I got the ring, I was ready with the gun, you know, like let's scan some things. Let's scan some things. I went to your baby bridal showers and baby showers, and I got you nice gifts. My turn, right? So here we are. Do we need all this stuff? And I'm like, what's wrong with you? You know? Yes. And he said, no, really. And he's looked at me and tears in his eyes, and I'm like, oh geez, okay. We talked it through, and that's when he talked to me about, my dad makes like $500 to $1,000 a year, Christy, and we're like sitting here with that much in gifts. What do we do? How do we hold poverty and wealth in our hands? And even when it's wealth that we don't feel like is wealth in an American standard, it is wealth in a global standard. And making sure that we keep that in perspective. Do we want our marriage to be more about giving than getting? And we ask ourselves, do we want to be known? How do we want to be known? Known as the couple that had the sexiest cars in the driveway and that's it? Or known as a couple that used our resources to give God glory and to save children from poverty and save people from poverty, to change their stories? And that's when we started doing research. David works in financial services, which means we research everything. And then we research it again before we purchase. And so if you're married to one of those people, we can give hugs after. It takes a long time to purchase or give or any of that. But I love that about him because we want to be good stewards, you know, that the things we have, we don't want to just give money away to, like, feel good about ourselves. And so that's when we did research to find where would that focus be. And as Jill mentioned, we got involved with Compassion International because we realized that they were the best at managing our money, that 86% of every dollar went straight to the kids, that it took care of their medical, their food, their water each day. They get 3 meals a day. It supported their education. It gave them a community of people that cared about their details and didn't just let them run wild and be forgotten. And it told them a different story about their life, that God loved them, that he had a plan for them, and that he isn't just telling a story like poverty tells, which is there's not enough for you. You weren't meant to be. It changes that, and it allows kids to dream again. And so it's been really cool to be part of it. We now have 4 kids we sponsor. Rohit was our first, and then Dia and Alex live in the same community David's father does in India. And then recently we sponsored Vivian because we're always just trying to make room for one more at our table. When I'm real about it, my friend Tony said to me when we first started doing this, he said, "Christy, let's be honest, it's one large Diet Coke at McDonald's a day." And I said, "Tony, you know I'm trying not to drink Diet Coke or tell people I drink Diet Coke at least." He said, "Well, I know you're a Starbucks girl, so that means you should be at like 10, you know?" So he's got a challenge out there for me, and we're trying to raise the roof to meet it. But what this has done for me is it's helped me realize that people do matter most. They matter more than stuff. And I've seen my friends use this as the greatest tool and resource to teach their kids that value too. Because Compassion believes in having a relationship with the kids you're sponsoring. You'll get letters back and forth like your pen pals. It's amazing. I'll get the letter, I'll open it up. I'm a blubbering mess reading that this little girl, Dia, is praying for us and her parents are praying for us and they hope good things for us. And what are you doing? How is life? You know. And David will take the letter and I'm thinking, man, like, come on. You know, he gives me this look like, oh, you emotional woman, you know, you're crying over this. Yeah, it is wonderful what we're doing, yeah, for this little girl. Then I'll go outside and find him reading it, sobbing, and I'm like, ah, got you. You know, it's like this has gotten so real for us and real and personal because, like I said in the beginning, I've walked on these roads. I've walked amongst the people Compassion is serving, and I've seen it and how it transforms the lives of those that are involved. We were driving up that road where I showed you, and everyone along the road was just desperate, like begging, and I'm like, oh, this is just too much. So overwhelming to see that kind of poverty, see that desperate human look in their faces. We drive up the road to this community at the top where this church has become a compassion center. You would think they were wealthy and doing great, or at least they had enough. And that's when I learned that the opposite of wealth, the opposite of poverty isn't wealth, but enough. And that is really the opposite, that's the antidote to entitlement, friends. It's teaching our kids what enough is. What is enough in a world of more? How do we teach kids not to just strive and strive and strive to get and get and get, but to be people of gratitude and grounded in the truth of what is? All right, our next one is your choices have consequences. This is also important for eliminating entitlement. These are positive and negative consequences. Do you understand that? Like, it's like not just consequences when you do something bad, but consequences when you do something good. But they have to be merited, right? There's been a lot of writing recently on trophy culture. Anybody read anything on that? Like kids getting too many trophies that they didn't earn? And how that impacts the way they feel about hard work and winning. And I worked with the Department of Education and this guy, Tim Elmore, that I told you about before that I'm going to tell you about now, on a project where we were helping the Nebraska Department of Education form a values-based curriculum to teach kids values. Now, let me tell you why. This was fascinating to me. 10 of the major industries in Nebraska came to them and said, "These kids aren't employable. They have no work ethic. We've tried, but we need to start early teaching kids values and work ethic so they know how to be a good employee, how to thrive as an adult. You see, if you get everything without earning it, you don't know what it means to work hard, how to earn it. When things are all free, it's easy to think everything is free. And when you find out it isn't, it's easy to be a whiny, spoiled brat, right? Here's a great quote. Kids need to fall a few times to learn it's normal. Teens likely need to break up with a boyfriend or girlfriend to appreciate the emotional maturity that lasting relationships require. If parents remove risk from children's lives, we'll likely experience high arrogance and low self-esteem in our growing leaders. You see, the impact of taking away the sting of something hard is that we don't know the value of what we just experienced. Does that make sense? It's not usually through easy things that we grow, is it? We grow through what's hard, and we have to be allowed to go through what's hard. And so one of the greatest and easiest ways to teach consequences to behavior is to follow through on, obviously, the consequences that are being set for behavior, but also through having allowance and allowing kids to see and to be part of a community structure in your home where they're contributing to the home environment and they know that their work matters and that if they take the trash out, the consequence is that the kitchen doesn't stink, right? If you don't take the trash out, the kitchen stinks. There's a consequence either way, right? We use this example a lot in our relationship where we talk about, this is from our premarital counselor. It was great. He said, imagine you're in line at Starbucks and someone steps back and steps on your foot. Ouch, right? And then turns around and says, oh, sorry, I didn't mean to. Does your foot still hurt? Yeah, of course it hurts, right? So just because we say sorry doesn't erase the impact of what's happened. So we need to make sure that kids know that. That doesn't erase, that just kind of saying my bad and I'm sorry doesn't erase what you've done. And the last one I'll show you is you are loved and so is everyone. Now this is interesting because I think my life mantra has been, you are loved. You need to know you're loved. You're loved by God. That when the sun rises in the morning, the God of the universe is close and personal and with you and wants to spend the day with you because he loves you so much. That's my heartbeat, right? But I think also we need to remember that every one of us is loved. Every person on this planet, especially to know that even the most annoying, agitated, exhausting people are loved by God, created by God in his image, have unique fingerprints that make them who they are. And when we can teach kids that people matter most to step outside of themselves, to wonder what it's like to be homeless, to wonder what it's like to be these different people that they encounter and meet, then we know how to respond best in love. Because the greatest command is to love the Lord your God with all your heart, mind, and soul, and then love your neighbors as yourself. Now, loving your neighbors requires empathy. It requires knowing how to love them well so you can step into their shoes and respond with the kind of needs to the needs they have. Oops, I'm going to go past these real quick. In closing, I just want to share with you that my friend April, she has three boys now, new baby. So three boys, and her two oldest both sponsor a child with Compassion. And they did this long before I was connected with Compassion at all. And she said the other day they were cleaning out their closets, and they had about 9 bags of clothes that they cleaned out. Have you ever done that where you're just like, I can't believe I have this many clothes and that I still have things left to wear, you know? And they loaded them into the back of her minivan and they went down to the Salvation Army or wherever they were donating them to. And then they drove home. kind of a non-event in life, okay, right? Just a task, an errand. They came home, they opened their mail, and their little boy, the Sebastian sponsors, the oldest, said, "Thank you so much for my t-shirts, for my birthday gift, because I was able to buy 5 t-shirts." And Sebastian's eyes were the size of saucers, and he said, "Mom, we just threw away like hundreds of t-shirts." And she goes, "I know." She says, "He's happy about 5 t-shirts." And that was kind of it. It was this little moment. And she said, "Christy, I've had a million teachable moments because he has this relationship with a child in poverty. It's an ongoing relationship." And a lot of the academic research right now supports that children need to have a connection to a name and a face and a person that they can empathize and know, because their brain development hasn't gotten to an abstract place yet where they can kind of imagine those people in Africa that we're helping or giving money to, or even honestly sometimes these where we take kids to feed the homeless, so good, right? So important and good, but sometimes can be impersonal, not personal. So when you have a friend that lives in poverty, or in our case, you have a father-in-law who lives in poverty, it makes it really personal. And that's what causes transformation. And so in closing, I'd love to show you a quick video. Let's see, what time is it? Yep, okay. Okay, you sure? All right, it's 2 minutes. Quick video that kind of shows the history of compassion, how it started, which I love, this guy Everett Swanson and his story, how he started this. There are now 1.9 million children on this globe who are connected and sponsored by a person like you and I who've made room at their table for one more child. And then you'll see the 1 millionth child and his true story. He was sponsored by a Korean bodybuilder. You'll see her too, flexing her muscles, crazy. But it just shows that everyone can do this, whether they're a child or a grown-up. I had a 14-year-old the other day come up to the table, and she picked up a packet, and she said, "I'm from Ethiopia." And I said, "What?" And she said, "I was adopted from Ethiopia." And I said, "No way." She said, "And this little girl's from Ethiopia." I said, "Amazing. How old are you?" She said, "I'm 14. And I said, "Okay, well, is your mom here?" "No." "Okay, we'll fill it out and we'll just see." And she says, "No, how much is it?" And I said, "It's $38 a month." And she said, "Easy, I can babysit for that in one night." And it humbled me. And as I went home to David, and I was like, I think it's time to maybe sponsor a few more kids if a 14-year-old's like taking me to school here, you know? I got this. This is easy. I'm like, "Oh, you're right. You're totally right." So here's the video. I just want to show you. It's a good one. I love this. I just love every time seeing his story, because I've stood in little houses like that and that they had prepared with immaculate detail for our arrival and our visit. And it's real. It's really real how much this is transforming the world. They actually, the World Bank has stated that by 2030, we could be very close to eliminating extreme poverty on the globe if we continue at this pace. It's exciting. And it's exciting that our kids could be part of that generation that brings food and water and basic needs to everyone on this planet. Right here is Oliver. And we're going to sponsor Oliver, actually. This week, we decided we'd add another one. So Oliver lives in Mexico. He is, 2011. So he is turned six in September, 5 in September. He'll turn 6 in this next September. And he's been waiting, because he has this little priority stamp, he's been waiting over 350 days to find out if he gets to be sponsored by one of us. And so, if you would like to do this today, man, I'd be so honored to get to share in this with you, because it's just been powerful to get to be part of this movement. All you need to do, you can take this home to show your kids, and there's a first letter in there. You can start your first pen pal letter relationship with this child, and it has all their facts about who they are, what they do, but I have to just know who's taking them home. So you'll just fill out this form front and back and bring that to me at the table. And I have some art word posters, some of my writing that I've put in posters and designed for you to take home as a gift. If you'd like to do that, they're normally $10, but I just love to give you one as a gift to say thank you out of the work that our passion of helping children. So I'd love, if nothing else, that we pray for these kids today. And they're on your tables right now. So if each of you would take a child in your hands, learn their name, look them in the eyes. I'm going to close this in prayer, and I'd love it if we could at all the same time lift up their names to God and say their names out loud, giving them dignity that they are seen, they are meant to be. And we'll just pray for their story and that God would help them with everything that they need. So will you bow with me in prayer? I'll make it really obvious, don't worry, when it's time. God, thank you so much for the work you're doing, God, in us, through us. God, we pray that you'd continue to grow us to be more like you, that we would be leaders for our children, leaders for the children in this world, that they would see us as people who will walk alongside of them. God, we just pray for each child that's represented by each mama in this room, by each grandma in this room. We pray for them as they emerge in this changing culture, God, that you would keep them safe, that you would hold them close to your chest, and you'd teach them who they are and who you are. God, we pray deeply that they would not grow to be entitled and spoiled, God, but it's those moments, those little sparkles of moments of, I want it, Lord, that there'd be also so many more moments of transformation, of aha, of getting it, that everything we have is a gift from you. And God, we're grateful. We're grateful for this group and just for the kind of community that happens around these tables. And Lord, we pray for these kids living in poverty, Lord, that you'd meet their every need, Lord. Right now, today, as either they're waking up or going to bed, Lord, wherever they are on this globe. God, you know their name, and we're just so grateful. And so we want to say these names out loud and honoring you and your call to love the poor. And so we'll say those names out loud together right now. Oliver, go ahead. God, I hope that rumble and jumble of names just makes you so happy. We want to see what's unseen in this world, and we want to honor the least of these. We pray this in your name. Amen. All right. So yeah, just come if you want to come connect with me. I'd love to. I'm going to put up some, or you have questions on your tables for discussion. And I'll be here. I'm not going anywhere. My mom's over there, and we'll just hang out. If you have questions, if you'd like to talk about this, gosh, I'd love to. I'll actually make my way around the tables quietly. I won't interrupt you. But if you have a question, just grab me, and I'll answer any questions you have. But thanks, Jill.